started versus absolute temperature when you finished. You measure absolute temperature in degrees Kelvin. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yeah, we get back to PV equal NRT.
And PV equals NRT. The T, I think, has to be in Kelvins for that formula to work.
It's the absolute temperature.
And absolute temperature in degrees centigrade is called Kelvin. Absolute temperature in degrees Fahrenheit is called Rankine.
Geez, does anyone use that anymore?
It's still listed in scientific journals, Rankine.
Okay, I mean, I know a lot of guys who would love to do away with the entire English measurement, and they want to go metric, because it's only really used in the United States and one strange little place. I forget if it's Panama or Guam or something, but we're the last handout.
I wonder what percentage of the American public knows that normal body temperature, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit, is, I believe, 37.0 centigrade.
I would say maybe 5 to 10% of the population, and I'm an optimist.
I'd like to believe essentially every physician knows that. What do you think, Roy?
Yes, I would hope so. Although we all recorded in Fahrenheit, because we live here in the United States of America, where Fahrenheit rules. Comment? Comment away.
As a cancer survivor and patient, I can tell you that more and more when you go into a hospital, they're talking about your body temperature in centigrade these days.
Okay, that's good to hear. Science marches on. I think when I was in the hospital, they still had both numbers on the graph, so you could do it either way.
I'm sure you're right, but it's just that, you know, this has been an over 10-year odyssey for me, and certainly 10 years ago, it was definitely Fahrenheit, and now, more and more, it's centigrade, and one whitey white.
Hey, that's a good trend. I mean, if I talk to my patients in centigrade, I would worry that they would even understand me less than medical gibberish at them. So I try to keep it Fahrenheit for people.
So to put it in numbers that make some sense, 37 degrees centigrade, normal body temperature. My guess is the physician becomes very alarmed if your temperature goes to 40 degrees centigrade, which is 105 Fahrenheit. Go ahead.
Yes. Proteins start to congeal farther up than that, which is very bad to congeal. I mean, just look at a scrambled egg. It's not usually as big a problem for adults as it is for children. It's very dangerous for children because they have far less volume and can control their temperatures well. And so there are large, long histories of children who suffered brain damage from febrile episodes. You know, they even call them febrile seizures when there's brain damage in some cases. It's terrible. But yeah, there is a temperature at which life is not amenable.
And an awful lot of people don't realize that you really want your human body to, I'm going to pick a number, not exceed 105 Fahrenheit for a whole lot of reasons. By the time you get to 106, you're probably in a hell of a lot of trouble, and maybe you're not even conscious, I'm guessing. You can be in a desert area in California, for instance, or in many other places, like Pakistan recently, the temperature went to 122 degrees Fahrenheit. A person sitting absolutely calm, doing nothing, in 122 degree Fahrenheit weather, is in a huge amount of trouble in the shade. The only way your body can get below the temperature of the surrounding air is you've got to be evaporating fluids very rapidly. So you better be consuming a lot of water. The wind better be blowing against you so you can evaporate that very fast. And that's an extremely life-threatening temperature as I see it. And if you run out of water and your body has to start using its own fluids, boy, you can get into a lot of trouble in a hurry. So anything above, let me pick a number, 104 degrees Fahrenheit air temperature, you've got to do some very careful things to make sure you don't get in a lot of trouble. Over to you, Roy. KQRIW.
Yeah, you know, temperature is not anything to laugh at, and it's not like going to the desert is the only dangerous thing. Every single summer, during heat spells where electricity gets turned off, you'll hear reports of older people dying from heat stroke in their apartments in ridiculously hot environments. So it's not that difficult, unfortunately, for that to happen. You know, the body is well designed for heat regulation, but you have to feed it with a lot of water, and you have to make sure that the humidity, the relative humidity, isn't... You know, if you got something that's 99% relative humidity, lots of luck using evaporation. It's not going to really be efficient.
Somewhere around 1980, as I remember, there was a heat wave that hit the southern portion of the United States. Something in the vicinity of 5,000 people died during the heat wave. And a decade or so ago, there was another heat wave in France where something like 5,000 people died. Spread out over a significant period of time. Usually these are elderly people. They don't have as much representation in the news reports and so on. And so, in some cases, a big deal wasn't made about it. And in case of those people in the southern United States, let me drop. A lot of these people were operating the house. These are elderly people operating the house with the door locked, the windows closed because they're worried about burglaries. And they didn't have the money to run the air conditioner, and they died in their beds. One of the things that I fault the media for is in that case, they didn't give people the information they needed. Most of those people had a shower or a bathtub. When the temperature is that high outside, your body is becoming overheated. One quick way that you can control your body temperature is to run cool water in that tub and sit in that tub with your clothes on if need be. But that's a survival mechanism. You can tolerate a huge amount of air temperature if you're sitting in a body of water at some reasonable temperature that comes out of the faucet. That survival mechanism, that training should have been given to those people over news reports. It wasn't. And 5,000 of them died. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
AC2GS. Well, that's a great idea. It's a shame that they didn't do it. But, I mean, you don't even have to go back in time much. The last hurricane that hit Florida, there were a whole bunch of adult facilities where their generators died. And rather than transporting them to something that had air conditioning, they just kind of sat around waiting for something.
And some of those people sitting around, did they get in trouble, Roy? Go ahead, and then go to the new person.
Supposedly they did. They were put up on charges, and I haven't heard a word since then. But hopefully they'll add something to these people, because it was inconvenient for them to transport elderly people from a building with no power supply to one. I think it was across the street even. It wasn't even that far, and they just sort of couldn't be bothered. It was a shame.
N2HVR, comment.
Yes, please comment.
Yeah, Roy, you're right. It was like last year, there was a news report where elderly people were in a home or something where the air conditioning failed. It was really hot. And there was a hospital right across the street that had air conditioning, and yeah, they all got in trouble because all they had to do was move them across the street. This was only like a year ago. I remember seeing it on the news. Back to you.
Yeah, that was the last hurricane season before, unfortunately, Puerto Rico got destroyed and involved in chicaneries about power supply maintenance and such. But there should be a ring in hell where those people who couldn't be bothered should land eventually.
Hey, Ro, I have my question if I could.
Ask away. I don't want to impinge poor Paul's space report much more, but okay, what's your question, comment?
Hey, sorry, KD2PPF. I was just wondering, in hot weather climates, would you actually suggest taking a salt tablet, the salt pill. Me, myself, I found they work, or they do work, but as being a, you know, doctor, is salt a good alternative in a hot climate?
Well, I wouldn't say it's an alternative. It's useful in that you will get so much perspiration. Perspiration does have salt in it that you'll lose sodium, so it replaces all the salt that you're losing through perspiration. You still have to combine it with fluids. Salt alone is going to dry you out. It's not going to really help. But you want to keep your electrolytes. If you keep sweating your salt water and you just pour in pure water, you're going to have an electrolyte abnormality on top of all your other problems, and that promotes weakness and muscle spasms and all manner of problems.
In the case of the Puerto Rico hurricane, which I think was last September, and the electric power system really got devastated, therefore they couldn't pump water through the normal procedures, and therefore people had to be continuously drinking water, and therefore they were drinking very unsanitary water and got into all kinds of troubles over that. You can do without water under ideal conditions no more than 3 days. Under heat conditions like that, where you have to be sweating to control your body temperature because the outside air is so hot, you need a lot more water than that. So we needed to give them portable water purifying systems, which is a filter-like device, not very expensive. I'm amazed that, let me drop this. President Trump went down there and he threw paper towels at these people as if that's what they needed. That's the last thing they needed. They needed a way to get potable water to a large number of people in rural areas that were suffering high temperatures. And they were forced to either drink very unclean water or die. And drinking the very unclean water got them into a lot of trouble. I'm amazed that our FEMA-like people didn't realize that need. They needed water a hell of a lot more than food just to survive. And they weren't being supplied a way of getting it. With the right kind of filter device, you can take muddy water out of a puddle and purify it and drink it. And there's a device that will give you 22 gallons of water in something that's the size of a jerry can. That can keep a family with water for a long period of time. Over to you, Roy. KTRIW.
AC2GS. Actually, they did have water purification. They had awful distribution systems. Basically, you had to go into the big towns to get anything because they couldn't find truck drivers. They couldn't ride on the roads. They couldn't do anything. So they had these things, and there's actual footage of some woman showing Trump the water purification, and he was a little confused and thought that she came from the company, and he started to ask how much they cost, and she told him that we're giving them away, they're free, and he just kind of smiled and walked away. So they were actually on hand. How many they were able to give into the right hands is questionable.
We probably should go over to the space report, though, Roy.
Would concur. I'm feeling very guilty about doing this to Paul.
Thank goodness Paul is a fast talker. He's got a very compact way of giving us the information. And if you run out of time, Roy, we promise we'll give you more time next week. WS2N, the space report number 700, here we go, 300, K2RW. Take it away, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N for the space report. And yeah, no problem, Roy. And we tend to zip through these things. And then, if you want to ask questions on some of the topics and launches that have gone up or are going up, then we go through that afterwards, no problem. Last Wednesday, we had an EVA. NASA sent two people out, Drew Pustel and Ricky Arnold, two astronauts, successfully had a 6.5-hour EVA. It's one of two. They're going to do another one next month. And the idea is to move some equipment. They really needed to get some spare ammonia pumping systems that they normally use to cool down the electronics and the heat that's generated in the the ISS to the radiating panels. Well, they have extra parts that have been delivered over the years, and a couple of broken parts, and basically some house cleaning. They needed to get them from one location to another location. And they also did some camera work. Once in a while, these cameras fail for whatever reason. Sometimes it's cosmic rays that wipe out the electronics, and all of a sudden a light will fail, or a camera itself will fail. And they did some of that work as well. But another successful EVA. Let me drop it. The next launches, last week I was talking about three important launches. There was the Grace Iridium launch that was going to take place in California. There's the Cygnus Antares launch that's supposed to take place in Wallops Island, Virginia. And then there's another one by China. They plan on sending a communication satellite to the moon, and it was going to happen like 3 days in a row. Well, two of the three got delayed by a couple of days. For instance, you have the Grace Iridium launch that's going to go up on the 22nd, a couple of days from now, from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The Grace has two parts. They have two satellites in the Grace system, and they're the ones that are going to be following one another, using both RF and laser to measure the distance between them exactly, precisely, like the thickness of a hair. And they're going to be measuring the gravity gradient around the Earth in a somewhat polar orbit at a couple of hundred miles up, probably around 350 miles up. And then what happens is, being in that polar orbit, you can get an idea of the whole Earth over time instead of just going into an equatorial type of orbit. You can cover larger portions of the Earth. Now, with GRACE, is going to be five more Iridium satellites. Iridium is a combination launch. SpaceX keeps launching, usually 10 at a time, but this time they're going to do five, and then the two GRACE launches. And I'm interested in the science that eventually comes out of that. The next important launch is actually about 5 hours from now. Now, it was supposed to have gone up actually this morning, but there was a delay due to the weather. You saw the bad weather we've been having here, and that holds true in Virginia as well, in Wallops Island, where Orbital ATK is going to launch the Cygnus cargo spacecraft to the International Space Station on their own Antares rocket. They have their own rocket. They have their own RD-181 engine. That's the newest engine that they use compared to the older one that they used to use. So Orbital ATK, private company, has a contract with NASA to bring up over 7,000 pounds of science equipment and also food and stuff for the clothes and stuff for the six astronauts that are on board. The other interesting flight I talked about last week is from China. It'll go up on a Long March 4 rocket to the L2 position of Earth, Moon, L2, Lagrange point. So that'll be about 60,000 or roughly 40,000 miles past the moon, and it will stay there because, there are balance in the gravitational pull between the sun, Earth, and moon. So this way that will stay in that one position and act as a relay, or basically a repeater in the sky for China. Toward the end of this year, maybe November, probably it looks like December, they're going to have another launch to the moon, China is, and they're going to use this repeater because they plan on landing a spacecraft on the south part of the dark side of the moon, the far side of the moon, near the south, though. And to do that, which has never been done before, since the moon doesn't turn, we would never have communications with anything that lands there. So they'll send signals up to the repeater, and then that will be able to see the lander and Earth at the same time, at all times. And the lander includes their rover, so they have a smaller rover that's going to ride around for a couple of weeks. They hope to get a month out of this. That tells me they're trying to do better than last time. I think they got a couple of weeks. Last time they landed spacecraft on the near side of the moon, and they had a rover that was successful back in 2013. Let me drop it. On this Cygnus, going back to the Cygnus launch, they have many different science experiments that are going up there, including one that they plan on trying to stop atoms completely in motion. They're going to use a combination of laser beams and a coil magnetic field to try to stop these atoms in one particular location. And they want to be able, you know, as far as the physics people are concerned, they want to be able to do this. And they can do it for like short periods of time on Earth, but up in microgravity, they will probably be able to do it for long periods of time. And the idea of it is to study the quantum effect of stopping molecules or atoms in space. And by studying quantum effects, it might help eventually in quantum computing or atomic clocks. Not sure how that's all going to work, but they are planning on studying that. So that's one of the science experiments that are going to be going up on Cygnus. And they have a lot of other experiments, including the something called microgravity investigation of cement solidification. They call it ICE. And they want to test cement. They're going to have little packets of different types of cement, and they're going to add water to it, just like it would be here on Earth. And they want to see, you know, its effects and how it hardens. There's a whole, looks like a big pad filled with dozens of these different little packets of different experiments. Some of the experiments are going to stop midstream. They're going to add alcohol to it and see if they can stop the hardening process. And then eventually, they'll be sending this back on a SpaceX Dragon spacecraft back to Earth so the scientists can look at this stuff. The idea of this experiment is eventually they would like to make cement structures, apparently, in space if they could. Long-range plans of building some kind of modules, you know, instead of out of aluminum and, that they do now, big aluminum cans for one module after the other to live in and work in. Or what Bigelow has is Bigelow Space builds inflatable modules that, in fact, right now, they still have one attached to the International Space Station. That was supposed to last 2 years. It's now over 2 years. So that's very successful. Somebody would want to also be able to try to make something out of cement if they had to in the future. Very strange, but that's one of the experiments. Okay, this is WS2N. Another launch coming up in 2 weeks. Is from Kazakhstan. Russia's sending up three more people to the International Space Station. They'll be joining a crew of three. Right now there's a crew of six. on June 3rd, you're going to have the crew coming back, landing in the steppes and fields of Kazakhstan, coming down on parachute. And now we'll leave three up there. 3 days later, they're going to send astronaut Alexander Gerst up there. He's from Germany, from the European Space Agency, studying with NASA. In fact, he's got a NASA call letter, KF5ONO, an American call letter. So he'll be active on the Ares. Along with this one woman, Serena Onan, her name is, and she's KG5 TMT. She must have just got a license because I look her up on QRZ, and I was the 22nd person to look her up, so I don't think she's had a license too long. When she goes up into space, that number will change very quickly. And also a Russian, he's going to be piloting the, he'll be the commander of the Soyuz that's going up. Sergei Prokopy, I think his name is. I'm pronouncing that wrong, but they'll be going up. And the interesting thing about the German astronaut is he will be coming, eventually, the commander or the second commander of the International Space Station from the European Space Agency. Usually most of the commanders that have you have to understand, there's six people, or three or six usually, on the International Space Station. And they have a commander who's in charge, just like a ship at sea. And whoever is in charge eventually turns it over to somebody else. The German, Alexander Gerst, will eventually become the commander of the International Space Station. So, let me drop it. Okay, Dick, I know we talked about the web warm electronic box last week or the week before. So, yeah, I did get some more information about that. And it's true that, like what I said, was in the two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, they had these plutonium cells, what's it called, cells, inside the warm electronic box, the box inside the center of the rovers to keep the electronics warm, also to keep the batteries warm. There's batteries in there. Batteries have to be maintained at a certain temperature. You know, it has to be around, I think they said 4 degrees Fahrenheit to operate properly, and they have to be a little warmer than that to actually have them charge at night. And also they have a lot of the electronics when they're working, they are actually giving off some heat. So yeah, some of the electronics themselves have that, and they do have thermal electric heaters inside that, you know, supplement the warm electronic box. But these so-called cells that I'm talking about are really, they're actually plutonium dioxide. They're pellets, and I said they were about the size of a D battery. I was wrong. They're about the size of a C battery, C cell. That's what it is. So a little smaller than what I thought. But that's what's keeping the electronics and everything else warm, the batteries inside those two rovers. Well, one rover quit already, but the other one is still operating. Opportunity is still utilizing that. But since they have this half-life of, I don't know, 8-7 years or more, you know, if some astronaut went up to the Spirit rover that's just sitting there for the last, since 2012, and they opened up that box, it would actually still feel warm because those things are going to keep generating heat. Another system that had that was the Sojourner rover that went up in 1997 with the Pathfinder lander, and that little robot had the same type of system. Let me drop it. This is WS2X.
How well shielded is that C-size battery or D-size battery heater? I'm guessing that there's going to be some radiation coming out of that. And if the electronics nearby is not hardened, can't that do some damage to the electronics pole? Because in the case of the main thermal electric generator on something like the big rover now, all of a sudden I can't think of the name. Opportunity? No. Curiosity. The Curiosity rover. I think the thermal electric generator is on a long boom, keeping it away from the electronics because of the radiation, as well as some good heat sinking with the air. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Yeah, this is uranium-235. The ones on the thermal electric generator is 239, so it's a little different. And also these ones that are about the size of a C cell, actually they're smaller than that. The pellets themselves are about, I think there's a half a dozen pellets. And the size of an eraser on a number two pencil. But they're encapsulated and sealed in, probably hermetically sealed, I would imagine. This metal cladding of plutonium-rhodium. It's a plutonium-rhodium alloy. And it's surrounded by multiple layers of carbon, graphite, some kind of composite material. Nevertheless, the article I read, it was from a NASA site, too, said that they tested this, six different ways from Sunday, and they don't have problems with the radiation. They tried to destroy them, tried to break them open. Whatever this stuff is, they can't break it open because they worry about launching this and then having a failure and then coming back to Earth. In fact, ever since the Apollo 13 mission, when that failed, they had to jettison Aquarius. Aquarius had on it not 235, they had 239 on it, that re-entered the atmosphere. Where's that going to go, you know? So they've tested this stuff where they feel it won't leak back to you there.
Okay, sounds like it's reasonably well shielded, which means the amount of external radiation is a very low number. But still, I'd love to know what that number is. And sorry, I called you the wrong person. Go ahead, Paul.
Not a problem. Roy knows what he's doing. I didn't expect him to come back. They had a news conference last week, NASA did, regarding an old mission, actually. They talked about the moon Europa, which is the moon going around Jupiter. And many years ago, we had the Galileo spacecraft. Galileo was in orbit around Jupiter for like 5 years and running all kinds of experiments and tests, basically looking at a lot of the moons. So it investigated a lot of the moons of Jupiter. And one moon in particular they were very interested in was Europa. So now this thing has been, they deorbited Galileo probably back in 1996 or 7 or something. And it crashed it into the atmosphere of Jupiter. They didn't want to contaminate any of the moons. So here we are, like 20 years later now, in 2018. Scientists are still going back over the data. You know, we always talk about, these spacecraft, Voyager, they're still active, and some of these spacecraft that they get data from decades ago. This scientist is still working on it and using that data. So this one guy and his team was looking at some pictures from Hubble in infrared, and it looked like there was some kind of plume that came off of Europa. But they wanted to verify it. Let's look at the old data from Galileo, from over 20 years ago. And they have something called a plasma wave detector on Galileo. And they looked at the old information. And at a couple of points, one in particular, they noticed that it changed for unknown reasons. It just changed as it went past a certain spot and traveling very low in the to the surface of Europa. And they figured out what they were looking at was the magnetic field was actually bending at a certain point. It, you know, it was stable as it was going by, and they noticed it bent. To make a long story short, something to make that bend like that, they proved that the only thing that could be doing that is an actual plume coming off of Europa. You know, they've confirmed plumes coming from another one in the Saturn group Enceladus. They've already proven that, but now they have another one that they suspected might have this capability. Now that they looked at the old information, they've actually proven this. And the reason they get so excited about this is because, you know, okay, there could be, they really believe there's like an ocean full of water in Europa. And where there's heat, and there is heat inside Europa, and water and minerals, you know, the theory is, of course, there could be life. So now they want to send, well, the plans already of sending another spacecraft to Europa called the Europa Clipper. Probably launch in 2022, they said. That's their goal. And now they're going to design it. Every time it passes Europa, they expect around 40 different passes around Europa. It's not going to go in orbit around Europa. It'll make 40 passes. Some people want to know why let's just put it into orbit. It wouldn't be able to survive the amount of radiation coming off of Jupiter if it was that, you know, if it stayed that close to Europa for a long period of time. So it's going to be going around Jupiter, but making very close passes to Europa. Now they're going to be looking for these plumes that they believe are coming off at regular intervals. And try now this time they're going to bring some kind of detecting instruments that could, you know, confirm one way or another that there's life or the capability of having life there. I'm not sure, I'm not a biologist, but, you know, that type of equipment. So that's why they were all wound up and had a big news conference at NASA. You know, I thought they were going to tell me they found life on Europa, but after listening to the story, it was very interesting on what they discovered 20 years ago, and they're still at it. So, let me drop it. And that's pretty much it. I know you're interested in the test launch that went off about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and how successful that is at getting to its proper location. That's the one that's going to be looking at all the different stars, looking for planets. And they did run a test. I found it on the NASA site. It did take a picture of thousands and thousands of stars. So the picture came back. That was very successful. So they know all their cameras apparently are working. There's four cameras on that spacecraft. And that will probably go into operation maybe another couple of weeks, maybe middle of June, I guess. We'll have to see when that is. And another one that's doing good is InSight. That's the one that's heading to Mars. Going to launch a couple of weeks ago, and very successful launch out of California. And it's in the cruise stage now. It's got the cruise vehicle attached to it, attached to the InSight lander that will eventually land on Mars and take seismic test of that planet. Interesting enough, the two satellites that are following it, the Marco satellites, which I'm fascinated with, they're the ones that are really CubeSats. It's like three or four CubeSats in one. satellites are following inside all the way to Mars, and they're doing very good, and they sent a picture back to NASA. The idea of the picture was to confirm that the X-band antenna opened up properly. On board each CubeSat is one big, if you want to call it big, it's about a meter in square, X-band reflected. It's going to send signals back to Earth when it gets to Mars. And it also has the UHF on the bottom of it, which will be picking up the signals directly from the lander as it goes to EDL, and it's entry to set the landing. So both satellites are in perfect health, and they sent the picture back. And in the picture, they did show that part of the, they could see the X-band antenna was on, was open. But the way the picture that they took it in that same frame, you could see the Earth and the Moon in the same, same picture, same exact picture. So you can see the Earth and the Moon that's orbiting Earth. And when I looked at the picture, I guessed, this looks like it's about a million miles out. Knowing that Moon, Earth is about a quarter of a million miles apart, the angle that I was looking at it, I said, I bet this is about a million miles out. And then as you go through the article, they said it was around 700,000 miles out. So that was pretty interesting. Right now, it's probably about 2 million miles, because that was a week and a half ago when I took that picture. So it's on its way. It's got another, 30 or 40 million miles, actually more than that, to travel to get to Mars. When it gets there, eventually Mars will be about, 40 or 45 million miles away from Earth. But I think the total distance that it has to travel to get to Mars is 300 million miles. So gives you an idea of roughly 100 million miles between here and Sun. It's going to be traveling almost three times that distance. That's it for the SpaceNet report, Dick. We'll turn it back to you. This is WS2N, K2RIW.
Paul, on these satellites where they're suspending a proton in microgravity to see if they can keep it still, you listed a number of applications of that technology. And I wonder if any of these objects being suspended in orbit or in space are being used for a future gravity wave detector. The LIGO gravity wave detector has two arms that are around 4 kilometers long for a bunch of physical reasons. They didn't make those long arms any longer. They'd have greater sensitivity if the arms were longer. So therefore, a LIGO-like gravity wave detector in space. Let me drop it. As long as you can precisely measure the distance, laser or whatever, in theory you can make a gravity wave detector that can see lower notes, so to speak. In other words, objects that are further apart that are slowly coming together, whether they be neutron stars or black holes. So where do we stand on experiments to confirm that a space-borne gravity wave detector is possible and will be great advantage if you can do it? WS2N, K2RIW.
European Space Agency has plans for launching a gravity wave detector quite a few years from now, but I think it's 2031 or something like that. So that's a ways away. Three spacecraft at the L1 position, roughly a million miles apart from one another in a triangular fashion, looking at one another to see if one moves or not. That's a ways away. It's part of the LISA. They call it the LISA missions. Now, this one here is, did I say proton? Atoms. They want to be able to stop atoms in space. The idea is to bring the temperature. You have background space, the temperature is, 3 degrees Kelvin? Well, this they want to make, it's going to be like 10 billion times colder than the vacuum of space. So 10 billion times colder than 3 degrees Kelvin. And they plan on using lasers and magnetic force. And they show this. Now, this is going up on a Cygnus spacecraft tomorrow, probably about 4 hours from now. And that will be launched on the Antares rocket and docked to the International Space Station a couple days after that. And they unload all these different experiments. So the astronauts themselves will be doing these experiments. It doesn't say anything about using this for gravity waves, but, you know, the way scientists are, and you never know. NASA says they'll be using it for basically investigate quantum computers, make a...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Different sensors that they use, and we drop them. And I guess the scientists think that they could use it for gravity wave detections. You know, all they need to do is see something like this be successful on the International Space Station, and, you know, they'll probably find a million uses for it, you know. I wouldn't be surprised if that would be one of them. You know, you could have something, stay perfectly in one location without it moving, and have a detector to figure out if it does move. And I guess basically that's all you need. Right now they're going to use spheres, two kilogram spheres, cubes. No, they're going to be cubes in the ones that would be launched by European Space Agency in 2031. Back to you, Dick.
And I think you said the major motivation on this experiment is for quantum computing, which, by the way, is somewhat described in a little bit better illustration in the June issue of Scientific American. June issue of Scientific American also has a very nice article about the sun and predicting what it did in the past and what it's going to do in the future and how it got there and how we got here. So it's a fairly good issue. So I think you're saying the major motivation for the suspending objects in microgravity in fixed position, a zillion times colder than free space, is primarily for quantum computing. Is that what you said, Dupol? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's what NASA's reporting. That's the major thing. And also atomic clocks that will be used on spacecraft for navigation. And, you know, you got this type of thing would be new for spacecraft navigation. They're also setting up a sextant, an actual sextant, you know. And they want the astronauts to practice using that, because when they eventually go to deep space, either to the moon or to Mars, and everything fails, they want to be able to take out a sextant and look at the stars and see how everything works. So, you know, what's old is new again. Running out of time. Back to you, to K2RIW, WS2X.
Yeah, during Apollo 13, during one of the mid-course corrections on the way back to Earth, they were using felt tip marker marks on the window of the spacecraft, looking at the stars in order to do a poor man's sextant-like operation to do the mid-course correction. That was a real cliche of Apollo 13. I think I told you I got a chance to visit building number 30 at Houston soon after Apollo 13. That's when I was there. And they described to me how much closer it was to a real failure. It turns out that the astronauts on the secret channel had their last rites read up to them because they weren't quite sure they were going to survive. Okay, we've used up our time. That was TechNet number 1700. That was Space Report number 300. That was Science and Physics Report number 30. We'll be back next week if all goes well. 73, you all be kind to each other. And Roy and Paul, thank you for some very interesting information. And I'm getting some good positive feedback from both of you guys. K2RIW to be listening. You always want to say anything more. Particularly your addresses of, for instance, this report number 1663 from Los Alamos. AC2GS for any final pilot, K2RAW.
AC2GS, thank you, Dick. Thank you, Paul. Thanks to everyone who participated. Once again, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com if you want to contact me, ask any questions, or suggest any topics. I keep a list of all the links at roy.ac2gs.com. That includes the discussion on lightning that we talked about. It's on a PDF, and you just press the link on roy.ac2gs.com, and it will come to you. So thanks, everyone. Have a great week, and we'll do it all again next week. Maybe we'll talk about one of the brightest things in the universe being caused by one of the darkest things in the universe.
KD2RIW, KD2PPF. Just a quick question.
We might run out of time, PPF, but give it a try.
Hey, how you doing? Yeah, years ago, long years ago, I was a boom operator in the Air Force, and we did a lot of celestial navigation with the sextant up in the plane, KC-135. And there were some times that we, during the daytime, we would shoot the sun, and during nighttime, we would shoot the stars. And there were some times during the day that I actually, when you use your variable filters, your different filters, that I saw sunspots. Now, this was back in the 80s, and I remember someone telling me, oh, there's no sunspots. And I said, no, there's sunspots. You could actually see them. There was through the filters, they appeared black, but, and I wasn't a ham back then, but it was during the 80s, and it was two big black, and there were sunspots that you could see with your eyes.
I know to see sunspots with out magnification, you need a real good set of eyes. I've often used what's called a white light observation. In other words, there's a certain kind of a filter that has 100,000-to-1 ratio. This is a thin film, silvery looking filter. You put that on the front of your 8-inch diameter telescope, aim it at the sun, and boy, you see all kinds of nice things on the sun when you properly attenuate the signal. So, did you really see sunspots? Absolutely, I believe you did. And one of the other things that's hard to believe is, with the right kind of a telescope-like thing, believe it or not, every star is observable at high noon if you have the right kind of instrumentation. So I believe you really did do it. Back to you, sir, K2RIW.
Great, thanks. Yeah, no, I just thought I would make that comment because one of my, I'd say someone above me said, oh, there's no sunspots. And I said, no, there's definitely sunspots because through the whole week of that mission, I saw the same sunspots every day, and there was two of them, and they were, actually, if you think about it, they were actually pretty big, my eye, through a few different sun filters during the day.
We're really being cut off.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Thank you.
6:30. Welcome to the W2BL repeater.
Time is 5 a.m.